the best and the fountain, as if you're brewing me tea. My junior act, there's no need to qualify the right of the rose come fall. It's hand drooping now. I was a seat by the wood on the sign on the door that declared the establishment. Oh, oh, the door shut up. The shopkeeper scowled inside. My junior act, how will you tell it now if nobody's listening? Well, it's out.
Junior Rec by the band Fiverr with the Atlantic School of Spontaneous Composition. Simone Schmidt joins me tonight on Dangerfield on Indie 101.5. So Simone, that's a beautiful, beautiful song. And it's actually been really great kind of prepping for this interview tonight, because I've just been kind of going through like what a wonderful range of albums and styles that you have. And it's been a bit of a retrospective for me to kind of catch up and you know, listen to all your songs again. And so this album that you put out, So this is with a group that you called the Atlantic School of Spontaneous Composition. And you recorded this, I think, was it out on the East Coast with this group of musicians?
I recorded in Montreal, but I worked with them on the East Coast because they're mostly, were at the time based around Halifax. So Bianca Palmer lives on the South Shore in La Have. And actually, Jeremy Costello, who plays bass, was on the North Shore, and then Nick was in Halifax. So I would go out there, like, over the course of 2 years, I went and met up with them and just jammed, and we got to know each other musically, and then we arranged this album together.
That's incredible. And so, and you recorded it, I read, in something like 4 days, which is a very short amount of time.
Yeah, we did a lot of pre-production, and that was like, I guess, yeah, as I said, over the course of 2 years. But the idea was basically that these are all like improvisational musicians, and so they actually don't play the same thing twice usually. And they're really, really fun to communicate with musically and just to jam with. But when I would go and visit them, what I would do is I'd bring them songs and I would have chords and like my melody, and then we'd jam on them in all these different ways. And they're each really lyrical, interesting players. And so the songs would just change and shift. And the entire time that we'd hang out, I'd just record them. Okay. And then when I went home, I'd listen to the jams and then take what I liked out of each different like version of the song, and then try to arrange the song finally, but based on their like initial, you know, improvisational impulses. So it's really funny because ultimately like the arrangements are like all of these parts of like what they just did haphazardly, but like shoved together. And so we just practiced those arrangements and nailed them, and then over the course of 4 days, like, went in, and we worked at Hotel Tango with the engineer that I love, Gavin Gardner. Like, I always record to tape, and he's very good with analog, and we went in, and we were able to just really methodically go in and do this work.
And so you mentioned there, so you mentioned arrangement. So I know with a lot of, like, jazz, like, a lot of people that come from kind of jazz and classical backgrounds, are like they refer a lot to sheet music. So how did you kind of refer when you were deciding on your arrangements? Were you referring them back to sheet music, or was it an audio kind of reference that you did?
Yeah, well, we would sometimes I would like write out certain licks that they had played spontaneously at home, and then I'd like bring them back, but they're also like all able just to memorize music. So yeah, we did that. And I mean, like within reason, there are still like parts of the album that are like entirely spontaneous that were recorded on spot and that we didn't arrange, but it was, you know, important for us to have that breadth of like totally determined licks and then like these areas of full spontaneity.
And
so,
how did you learn music? Like, were you classically trained? Did you pick it up kind of late? Like, what was your background and how you came to play music?
Yeah, so I was like born to parents who made all of us learn piano.
Yeah.
And when I say like make, it's like there was just like no, you were not allowed to not take piano.
Me too.
And I at the time was really resentful of it. I don't know how you felt, but I really didn't take to it in any way, shape, or form when it came to expression. But I had this awesome teacher, Barb Morrison, and she did teach me how to practice. And so I think later on when I came to song in my like adult life, because I didn't really grow up thinking that I would be a musician or a songwriter. But when I came to it out of like a need to work out my mind and my emotions in some form outside of myself, I ended up like just having that literacy and also knowing how to practice. And so like when I went to learn guitar, I knew how to practice, or, you know, the challenges of learning things.
Yeah,
I feel really fortunate.
My piano teacher lived two doors up from me. And so my mom used to just say, you can quit piano, but you'll have to tell her yourself. And she knew that I would see her like every day, and I was too scared to do it. So it actually kept me playing up until like grade 9 conservatory, which was just smart of my mom to do that, I think.
Who's your piano teacher?
Her name was Michelle Griset. So she lived just up the street from me. And I was terrified of, well, I had to do the conservatory exams, and they were just torture for a kid. Like, yeah. I remember, like, you would go and sit at the conservatory, and you would hear the kids through the wall playing what you were about to play. And it was, like, literally terrifying. So I think that derailed me from ever going into any sort of musical pursuits.
Yeah, I mean, it can do that to people, right? And, like, I think that's why I'm like, my teacher was awesome, because we had to do the repertoire, but she was also like a contemporary musician. Oh. And I think like I didn't totally understand that at the time, but then like it's interesting getting old, because like I started to age to about the age that she was when she was teaching me, and she used to live in Kensington Market, and I would like go there by streetcar, and like she was a real like artist and weirdo, and now I realize like she probably would be my friend, right? You know.
So you did another album with the band that we just heard, and it came out in 2020, and it was called You Wanted Country Volume 1. So let's play a song off that. Let's play a cover that you did of Willie Nelson's song Why Do I Have to Choose, and then we'll come back and we'll chat.
Why do I have to choose? See everybody lose. Walk around and see the blues. But darling, I refuse. Love is hard to find. Love of any kind. A love like yours and mine creates its own. Why do I have to choose? See everybody lose. Walk around and sing the blues. Well, darling, I
Why Do I Have to Choose by Simone Schmidt, who joins me tonight on Dangerfield on Indie 101.5. If you want to check out any of their music, go to fiverr.com. It's actually a great website. I really liked pouring through it. And it'll take you kind of to all the different links to the different albums. So this album that we just heard a song off of, you put it out, and it's a mix of, there's two songs that were composed by yourself, and then there's covers by like Gene Clark, Willie Nelson, Johnny Paycheck. How did you come to choose what songs were going to be on this album?
Yeah, so I just brought a bunch of country music to these players, Bianca, Nick, and Jeremy, who are all not versed in the country tradition. And I just taught them the songs without playing them the original recordings. And then I saw which ones they took to, because I showed them like all my favorite songs, like showed them George Jones, Blue Must Be the Color of the Blues, and, you know, Drinking Don't Kill Me, and all these tunes. But it really was the ones that they played the best that I chose. Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, it's really funny watching people who don't really know country repertoire try to learn it.
Right.
Yeah.
And because so what was the process? Like, did you play, like, after they played it, then, like, then did you play them the original? Or, like, how did that work? And what was it like kind of watching them hear a song that they just played their own version to back again?
I would do it at different weird times, like in the car, just like sneak it in on a mix. And then it would take them a while to figure out that that was what I was playing, you know?
Way.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it is so different, you know, it's like, except one funny thing is that Jeremy Costello, who sings the song, Hating You, which is a Johnny Paycheck tune. Mm-hmm. He was like telling me that the first time he ever heard that song was on Grand Theft Auto.
He's a huge
gamer. Yeah. So like he knew the song from having played video games, which is so funny to think about. Yeah.
It's an interesting, especially in this day and age, like with radio not being really like an exploratory form anymore for people to hear music, that stuff like commercials and games are like an avenue for that. It's quite fascinating.
Truly, yeah. Because it's also so limited what people end up hearing on the radio.
Yeah.
Or on like, or what they're directed to if they're listening to like streaming, because the algorithm is kind of jacked in whatever favor they've already like thrown themselves in, right? So
yeah. And so kind of like that kind of leads into maybe my next question, which is, you know, the art of the album and kind of like, you know, when we were growing up, like when you would get, you know, an album and like the, you know, the tangibleness of holding a vinyl and or cassette and reading the lyrics and reading the artwork, like, do you think that that's kind of something that's gone, or do you think that's something that people are kind of going to revert to a lot more now as kind of like a revolt against the digital age, perhaps?
You know, I have absolutely no clue. I think it's going to really split.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people are going to be like, exist. I mean, I already know some people who exist almost entirely digitally, like on video games, and their experience of music really isn't ever through a live setting, and they don't have patience for an album.
Right.
But I also think that, I think that like people are going to become a bit more into objects in general, because like I think that everyone's brain is getting a little smashed up from the digital addiction. So I believe that there will be like more and more spaces carved out for people to try to reclaim their attention. And I think that that will be like probably exploited by some kind of music market. You know what I mean?
That's true. Now you put out, so in 2017, you put out an incredible album called Audible Songs from Rockwood. And it was a result of you like scouring years worth of medical records and patient diagnosis written by Rockwood's medical superintendent, which is, and so this is from a place in I think Kingston, Ontario, and then you accompanied it with a book as well. So can you talk a little bit about like how this whole project came to be, like what started this?
Yeah, so I was researching just prisons in general, because I was doing a bit of work with like an anti-immigrant detention like campaign with the group No One Is Illegal. And I came across this article at random in an internet search. It was from the Kingston Whig Standard, and it was about this asylum for the criminally insane that was opened in the 1850s. But it focused particularly on the fact that the superintendent who like ran the asylum was totally fraudulent. So he had actually lied about his credentials.
Uh-huh.
He Yeah, he can like move from Great Britain to what was like the new colony of Australia. And he lied there and told people that he was a doctor, even though he'd never like finished medical school. And he got money from the new government there to open an asylum. And then after 7 years was like discovered as a fraud. And he just like then went across the ocean to Turtle Island and like landed in what was becoming Canada. Right. And yeah. He knew like he knew the administration there. So he was actually friends with John A. MacDonald, and he got he got put in charge of this asylum for the criminally insane, which, I mean, this story just like really irked me. But there was this description of the way in which at the beginning of the asylum, they were building this massive edifice that would eventually house around 500 people. But at the time, they had to keep different people who were deemed criminally insane on the grounds. And so they put people in these buildings that already existed on this land that had been donated to the government. And they put like the men in this house that was formerly inhabited by the lawyer who had donated this land. And then they put the women to live in the horses stables. And when I read that detail that, like, you know, people were shackled in horses stables, I got a like very visceral feeling, and I went home and, or I like was at home, but I wrote a song. And so I wrote that song like in, I think, 2012, and I was carrying that song with me, playing around with my friend Chris Cool, who's like this tremendous banjo player, and we were playing old time music. And you know, it was kind of my way of thinking, like, what are the voices that don't come through in the North American, like, Anglo, like, canon? And, like, you know, a lot of women's voices, a lot of people who might have been locked up and their songs wouldn't have been heard outside. But and as I sang it, I was kind of reminded, like, all the time, like, I wonder, like, what life was actually like at Rockwood. So I started researching it, and I found that there was no books about it. There were only archives, and like one article that sort of guided me. It was about like 1,200 words, and I looked at the bibliography, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna have to go to the archives and like look at these primary sources. So that was just like this journey, because I'm not a scholar in any formal way. Like, I don't go to university or anything like that. And I had to learn all about archival research, which is just stunning enough. And yeah, so I did that for like 4 years.
Well, that's fascinating too, that because like that's in a university town. And so that's kind of so shocking that like all of that history existed without being kind of unearthed, like right under everyone's noses kind of thing too, right? Like,
totally.
And so what was the song that you referenced? Did that make it onto the album then?
Yeah. It's called Rockwood 1868. Although I think on that album, because I recorded it twice, so on this album it's called Stable Song.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, let's listen to that and then we'll come back and we'll chat.
Pattern of bare and restless feet. they clothed me in a canvas suit and leave me here to stew. My nights are shy with morphine, but it keep me from kicking through. The stable walls are washed with lime days, washed with alcohol, and the muffled sounds of the other girls and the other horses' stalls. Now it's a matter that matters that I'd rather keep to me. A matter that matters that's come to give me beat. And a matter of a memory that matters at me. Through the echo of the patter of beer and restless feet.
Song from Audible's Songs from Rockwood by Simone Schmidt, who joins me tonight on Dangerfield on Indie 101.5. If you want to check out their music, you can go to fiverfiverfiverr.com and you can get access to all the wonderful albums that Simone has created. So Simone, you also created for Summer Works, like a performance piece around this album that we were just talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about what that process was like and how you translated the album to stage and what that experience was like?
Totally. Yeah. So, I mean, the album is 11 songs and they're all based on different women whose case files I like found, or amalgamations of case files. So all people who like are actually pretty much invented by me, but ostensibly like, you know, like lived in some way. And so as I was touring the album, I would tell the stories of each person before playing the song. And so after about like 2 years of touring this album, I had this like hour-long show where I tell stories and sing songs, and it was great. It ended up having a kind of narrative arc that explored what it is to do archival research, all the ways in which you can kind of doubt like whether what you're reading about people is true, like questions about how much you can believe what someone's criminal record says,
right,
or how much people are like accurately represented by their doctor's notes. Like, what does a psychiatrist really know about a person? And so all these questions that had come up in my research also felt really like imperative to ask as I presented the work. And that's why like I wrote 30 pages of liner notes that goes with the album. Yeah. And then the live version of that like just seemed to grow and grow as I did the show. And it had this like logical to the order. And my friend, Frank Cox O'Connell, who's like a great director and actor, but he worked with Soul Pepper Theater. I asked him like, how would you make this into a theater show? Mm-hmm. And then we decided like, let's work on making a Black Box Theater show out of what I already had. So yeah, we just kind of took my live show and figured out how to stage it and like figured out how to really work it and make it more concise. And he's really skilled at understanding what works in theater versus what would work in a folk show. And it's really like, it was an incredible time to be directed, because I find so much of like work as a musician, and especially in that project, was self-directed. And it was really great to work with someone who could stage it and give me really great feedback. And yeah. And then I worked with a costume designer and a set designer, Shannon Lee Doyle. And that was just so, so helpful. So such skilled people work in theater. Yeah.
And when you, and so before you reference kind of playing with improvisational musicians. And so when you talk about like the stories that you would tell, like, did you find your, like, did your storytelling kind of shift every performance, or was it a strict kind of narrative that you committed to memory, or how did that work?
Yeah. So as I developed this show, like from just touring out, like my stories would change every night, but I started to realize like certain ways of telling some stories were more compelling than others, or, you know, the order in which I told them allowed me to give more of an overarching theme. You know, like when you're watching like an episodic show, like Star Trek, The Next Generation, and then there's like an overarching story about the Borg, you know, that like goes over, you know, so that would be like that, like larger arc would come through if right. I told the story, all the different stories in like certain orders. So I ended up like just like doing that work as I toured. Right. But then when I like got to the place of making this show for theater, I already had certain ways of telling the story. And yeah, I did kind of have to memorize certain things. And Frank, my director, was always just like he was always like, can you just like drive that point home? Like so strangely, like what is wrong with you? And I would just have to work really hard to make sense for sure.
And then did what you learned from performing in that way, so kind of with that direction from people, did that make you relook at how you performed on stage, or was there any kind of crossover then to what you learned there to bringing to your musical performances?
You know, I like after doing that theater show was like, I don't want to ever tell a story again on stage. And like, not forever. Yeah. I would love to do that show now, but I also haven't been able to perform for 2 years. So I've left to do any show, but I mean, I think, after doing something like that, I felt like theater is a real skill and I'm so fortunate to have done it. And then like music is this other thing and it's a totally different,
right. Because I guess with music, you have a little bit more of like, sorry to cut you off there, but like especially with like, you know, playing in, let's say, bar, like there's more of like kind of like, I'd say like more interaction with like immediate kind of cheering and stuff like that, that like maybe there's more of a pause in theater, right? Like you're not probably getting, exactly. Are you getting that immediate response in the from the audience, or what is that like?
Well, like part of a technique that I would use if I'm doing a regular show is I would ask the audience a question and try to foster a context in which people felt they could like have a back and forth and engage with me, you know? And like, even if I'm playing like the banter between songs, when I choose to do it in a different show, like there's a level of like engagement and art and exchange, but in a black box theater, the lights are off and you can't see the audience. And so you're just there. And so even if I were to pose like a rhetorical question, like people didn't know if they were supposed to answer or not. Right. Yeah. It was really interesting in that way. Just those formal differences in setting, like really changed what kind of energy exchange is happening. Whereas like, yeah, like in a regular like rock show, like it's just so much about the energy that you're exchanging. And then, Yeah. And I think people are, you know, people show up to rock shows also like performing themselves.
Right.
Like really, so right? True. Like everyone like dresses up really like in their way, and then yeah. they're getting, you know, tuned, and they like really are performing with you in a way.
Yeah.
It's like a pageant in a way.
Yeah. Well, and it's so interesting too. Like I'm sure you've noticed like in Toronto with, especially with the pandemic, but even before the pandemic with the music venues are kind of disappearing like one by one. And I was looking back before we were chatting and I was like, I always like before I interview someone for my show, I used to keep like very detailed show listings of the shows that I would go to. And it popped up like one year I had seen you perform 8 times, like as your band $100 in like in a year. So that was like pretty much averaging like once a month. So like you were like, so a play so much, especially around Toronto. And so actually, you know what, let's play a song. Let's play a song off $100, which is I think the band that I first heard of you in. And let's play Where the Sparrows Drop off your 2011 album, Songs of Man. And then we'll come back and we'll chat.
Crisis in the seed, it's so much grace. The 9 to 5 people working, chase wants every day. Nature's vermin stuck about in the walls, the pipes of grace. Truth be told, and shadows fold at the pools nowadays. Dusk is when all creatures come basking in golden chase. Every species acts as starving pieces of life. Fades. Take a shower of the worms, take a shower of the snakes. As it's just the sparrows drop, being all in one place. I sat there where the sparrows drop. That's where I was waiting. Come with the sparrows drop. Just as the day was waiting. There among the birds of thirst is where I'd calmly stay. Feels all the outside's match my inside's disarray. I knew no beauty but the dusk until that crucial eve. My beloved voices, I stood staring back at me. And if this town were small enough, they'd call us crazy cursed. But we in random sitting with ignored, which might be worse. I wooed there in nature's mess, my only and my first. And like a sparrow, she fell for me, my eyes and hers immersed. She said, meet me where the sparrows drop. That's where I'll be waiting. Tomorrow as the sparrows drop. As days faded in my youth, I made a deal, some lessons for my time. Between my trigger finger, plain faced Martian line. And just as I had found my peace, my country found its war. I was sent there overseas to fight who knows what for. And in the airport, in the crowd, my love, she wept for me. She held her hand on my back, small as real she could be. She said, I love you for your eyes, you know, cause they seem like mine. With every bomb, just see a sparrow falling down in time. She said, meet me where the sparrows cry. That's where I'll be waiting. Every day till your turn, just as the day is waiting. Of time in the trenches with the rest who lost their limbs and minds, and I can't see the detail now. The memory I know with every sound, explosion, feel the warmth around me glow. I clutch my rifle tightly, wrap the fire, scar bound. Hope to hit a sparrow, feel it fall onto the ground. She said, meet me where the sparrows drop. Days.
That was Where the Sparrows Rot by $100. And Simone Schmidt from that band joins me tonight. This is one of Simone's previous bands. So Simone, we were just talking about before the song about, you know, how the music venues have changed in Toronto. Like, what do you think, like, I guess, you know, the Silver Dollar, which is where I used to see you a ton, has no longer. So what's that pause from playing music been like for you, for as someone who used to tour a lot? Or do you find that it's kind of made you look at performing differently, or does it make you more anxious to get back to it? Or what's that experience like?
Oh man, it's like devastating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think at the beginning of the pandemic, I was so deeply disappointed. I couldn't even like look at it, because I released two albums throughout the pandemic, or like the EP and then the full length. And I had a pretty full slate of touring and had like definitely gotten some festivals, and I was excited to just be working for a year and a half. I'd made a lot of changes in my personal life in order to make that possible. And yeah, I just like really believe in this unit of musicians as live performers, because they're improvisational and it's so dynamic, and we just like love communicating musically. And to me, the live show has always been how I work. You know, I don't promote, like, I don't do that many press photos. Like, I don't really think it matters how musicians look. I didn't get into music because I wanted to make videos. You know, I got into music because I like to write songs and I love to perform and play music. So yeah, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, like I'm not like the kind of person who feels all that entitled to the space though. You know, like I recognize that like there's a lot of people suffering and many people who are going to have to keep working frontline and all that stress. And so I just kind of like turned my head to like what was the hardest thing I was seeing around. And there were like a lot of people living outside in encampments in Toronto. And I just like started organizing to do support for people who had lost their homes or like were living outside because they got kicked out of the shelters that had been reduced in capacity. And for like a good year, I was kind of volunteering 10 to 14 hours a day and kind of like doing that. And then, you know, as I started to like really reckon with like how much my life has changed and how much like I miss music, like I can really say like I feel like my life has been devastated by not being able to perform. And like, not obviously, like I have a home and I have food, and I know I am so fortunate in comparison to so many people at this moment, but there's still this aspect of like, if I refuse to grieve the reality that like, this is like what I trained to do for 15 years of my life, and now I don't get to do it. And who knows if we're ever going to be able to do it without taking like the risk of getting sick, you know?
I read this article, this really good article. It was like 1 year into the pandemic. I was talking to a musician friend recently who was like kind of struggling with almost like depression for the first time, and was like, you know, it's weird, like I'm feeling depressed. And so I was looking up articles to help and just to kind of explain it, because in the work that I do, this one woman had told me about how, like, you know, our brains aren't actually designed to be in this alert kind of trauma. It's this trauma-informed kind of way of thinking where you're like, your brain's on predicting danger, right, all the time. And then after a year of that is one thing. And then after 2 years, and then a lot of creative people, like, they're stimulated, like their parts of the brain are stimulated from that creative, you know, collaboration, that performance. And so it's actually, the brain is just, it's like scientifically like responding in this like very drastic way. So it's, it's a lot to take in. You mentioned before, like the just then about the work that you were doing. So you created the encampment support network, and you actually kind of galvanized a lot of artists and musicians to kind of, you know, take up that cause. So there was this beautiful kind of, I think people got involved that never would have thought about it before. And so, and I remember seeing all your very recognizable font, if I remember that from all your posters and t-shirts. And I was like, I'd walk down the street and be like, oh, that's Simone's handwriting. Like, you know, people putting signs up and really helping out. So that was great, great work that you've always done and continue to do. So that's awesome.
Yeah. It was really heartening to see like people really caring. And I think it is also just like this decades long crisis of homelessness. Mm. So like, even though there were this acute need at the beginning of COVID when people weren't getting any outreach and where the shelter system had really contracted, there's still this need, right? But now people are like a lot more immune to it. You know, and I think also the long-term impact on people now that CERB hasn't been happening, and it's just like a lot. Like, I think everyone's maybe in a worse position than they were at the beginning of COVID.
How has that impacted your creativity then? Like, are you finding like, have songs come out of it? I know that you're focusing a lot on your artwork now as well. You mentioned that you were just doing a residency, I believe, out of town. Like, has it been a creative like time for you to write more music, or what's that been like for you?
I think like this is the weird part, is that like my brain and music like sort of shut down. Mm-hmm. Like I play music, but I was writing a lot of like very clear information about the sort of struggle of people against the city that was evicting like all the encampments. And so like it was just like a lot of writing within like the imperative, like, you know what I mean? Like, just like every day kind of drafting and reading and thinking in a particular way. And I lost maybe I was like, as you were saying, on high alert.
Yeah.
And I still am, right? Like, just like total anxiety. I'm gonna be honest, I feel like I've been having an anxiety attack for 2 years.
Yeah.
And like, so yeah, like I haven't been able to work toward poetry in the same way that I have in the past, but I know my brain is starting to unwind and to start thinking in those ways now. I've seen like, I just had a lot of friends, like, sort, like, I mean, I'm not trying to be a downer here, but like, I have a lot of friends who've died in the past year, and I'm really like, yeah, I'm just really like not putting pressure on myself to be working within like writing songs. I know songs always come when they need to, and I do feel like I've never had to force a song. And so I started to just learn a new skill, which is like airbrushing.
Because
I always have like done visual arts, and it's never been my profession. I was a screen printer for a long time, and I designed stuff, but I never, you know, like studied formally. But yeah, I thought like, I'm gonna just start airbrushing because it's a new technique. And I started learning that and making shirts and stuff. And then I just was learning sign painting, like traditional sign painting, from this great artist, Pascal Arpin, out in Ottawa. And she just offered to teach me kind of the traditional strokes, you know what I mean? Like the old style, like beautiful, like casual fonts, and also like block letters. So all the techniques that people learn how to do, or used to learn how to do in vocational school, but like that people aren't teaching anymore because of digital technology, like those are all the kinds of things that I'm learning. And I don't know, for me it's just an exercise in trying to be grounded and present to like what my body's doing.
I was gonna say, that must be therapeutic almost, just like there's like, even like, you know, people writing like calligraphy or something, there's like a repetition and there's like a craft and it's like perfecting a skill that must be like calming almost to the brain, right?
Totally. And there's like a right way to do it. with song, that's not how it is. Like, you can do it well and you can do it badly, but like there's no right way. But yeah, so I feel like I've really relished in that, and I know song will come back to me. Yeah. I actually like have been making funny recordings with my friends, though, like my musical friends, like Nick Dorado and Nate Doucette, and we just make songs where I just sing, but there's never any words.
Oh no way! That's awesome. Yeah. Kind of like Bobby McFerrin. So you mentioned your airbrushing, so I want to give a shout out to how people can find that. So you've got an Instagram dedicated to that. It's called Title King Tees. So it's title_king_TEEZ. So Title King Tees, and Simone's commissioning some shirts on there, and they're so awesome. And it's been great to see, like, I've loved your other screen printing work that you had done. When we talked earlier, I was like, Simone, do you have any of that old stuff still kicking around? Because I've given away all your awesome shirts. But Simone, we're kind of coming up on time here. I could talk for a really long time, but it was really great to catch up with you. And I think that, it's just been awesome to kind of reconnect and give another listen through all your songs and really wonderful stuff.
Thank you. Yeah, Mary, like you're a person who I miss seeing at shows, and like you're someone who has always been such an awesome listener and appreciator of music. So I want to say thanks for remembering that and for asking me to be on the show. I really appreciate it.
It was so much fun, and let's keep in touch and we'll talk soon. Okay, Simone?
For sure. Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
When I broke out from Dayton, I did not know
check from being a rat tail hanging off the wrong man's neck. And you know retaliation, shooting from a bow that's badly bent, made from marks I did not tell you of, for they were never really meant. The way things go, you never know what comes behind you. Don't think that I don't share the same complaint. And if it's real, why can't I shake it? Must I wait for dawn to ditch me on the fireside of saying? Somebody else's meaning about the way of the words, how they swiftly traverse from the mic through the pen to the lover, then the doctor, now the copper. Where's a brand new way things go? You never know what comes behind. I've had my mind to write on a weather vane. And if it's real, why can't I shake it? Buddy, wait for dawn to ditch me on the fireside of sage.
Complain, but you still do.